He couldn't have known what a total, like, badass you were. But I bet he was maybe hoping you might want to stick up for him.
Badass.
My grandfather sampled the flavor of the word. It did not seem to revolt him, but it was nothing he needed ever to sample again. I bet he was hoping you'd be his friend. It sounds like he needed one.
He was, my grandfather said.
He did. He closed his eyes and appeared to drift for a little while, and I thought the afternoon's conversation might have come to an end. It was nearing 4. The palliative care nurse was due at 4:30. But then his color deepened, and he opened his eyes. They had the clarity of pain. The meds were wearing off.
Every infraction at Wallkill, you got time added to your sentence. Fighting, getting into a dust-up with another inmate, they would add a lot of time. Months. Months for one fight.
The only thing worse was if you tried to escape, going over the hill, they called it. And then, if you got into another fight after that, the way you probably would if you started something serious with a hard-on like Hub Gorman, they shipped you off to Greenhaven or Auburn, maximum security, where they put the bad guys, prison. Your mother was 14 when I went in, Mike, stuck in Baltimore where she didn't know a soul, living with a pool hustler and a grumpy old lady, stuck there till the day I come get her.
And your grandmother.
I know, I said. I'm sorry, I'm not reproaching you. Hey, I'm sorry, Grandpa.
He was looking out the window.
The Momser sat on the top of the fence, facing the ivy-tangled slope, its back to the bird feeder, making a show of indifference or surrender.
It's time for your pill.
I don't want it.
Come on.
I'm really sorry, okay?
Come on, you need it, Grandpa.
I said Grandpa again, but in an Eeyore voice. Then I said it in the voice of Darth Vader. He kept looking out the window at the squirrel, who was so much less trying company than his grandson.
What do you want to take it with? I said.
He rolled his head in my direction.
Cold beer.
Seriously? Is that okay? He lifted an eyebrow no more than a quarter of an inch, just high enough to say, what the fuck difference could it possibly make? I went to the kitchen, opened a bottle of Dos Equis, and poured some into a plastic cup. I was fairly new to California at the time, and Mexican beer still held considerable allure. On further reflection, I transferred the beer from the plastic cup into a tall glass, and topped it off from the bottle, tilting it so he could swallow his pill without getting a mouthful of foam. I carried the glass of beer into the guest bedroom with a certain ceremoniousness. For some reason, I was really looking forward to seeing him drink a little beer. He put the Dilaudid onto his suede tongue and washed it down with a healthy swallow of Dos Equis.
Rock and roll, I said.
He closed his eyes. In his contentment, he looked handsome and severe.
"Mm," he said.
Good, right?
Good.
Have a little more. I passed the glass to him again, and he took another long pull. He handed me back the glass.
Enough, he said. Thank you. Go ahead, honey, you finish it.
I sat down in the chair and had a sip of beer and watched him smack his lips. The complicated bitterness seemed to linger and resonate on his tongue.
Storch, what a nudnik, he said. I must have been nuts.
Chapter 26. At Wallkill, in the evenings, your time, for the most part, was your own. The recreation room had table tennis, board games, and a monstrous console with a record player and a radio. Partway through my grandfather's stretch, Dr. Wallach, the warden, had a new Philco television brought in at his own expense and installed beside the radio, so the men could watch the fights on Friday night. The casualty rate for ping-pong balls exceeded the rate of resupply, and the records, for some reason, were devoted primarily to polka music or instruction in Portuguese. Many of the board games were on their fourth or fifth set of tokens, counters, and dice, improvised or crafted by inmates from spools, bottle caps, corks, modeling clay. In the case of Monopoly,
The entire board had been redrafted onto a sheet of pine by some wistful or ironic cartographer who substituted the streets of Albany, New York, for those of Atlantic City, discounting all the properties by 50%. Reception on the television was dreadful, but many of the men would watch anything that passed across the screen of the Philco, furious blizzards of static, prize-fighting ghosts. Some of the prisoners, having exhausted the recreation room's store of wonders, simply retired to their cells every night. Many joined a prayer circle or weekly Bible study. Most of them took up a hobby sooner or later. They painted in watercolors and oils. They carved duck decoys, built birdhouses, bent sheets of metal into napkin holders. They turned table legs on lathes and then affixed them to tabletops they had coped and mortised. They put in extra time caring for the livestock, in particular the horses. My grandfather naturally found his way to the so-called hut, where in addition to a Hallicrafter's shortwave radio and a darkroom, there was a radio repair workbench. People from the towns and villages around Wallkill would bring their radios to the prison to be repaired for the price of parts. Radios went on the fritz in interesting ways and could be repaired in ways that were satisfying. It was a matter of having the right parts and the proper tools, and then ruling out the possibilities one by one. To my grandfather, that was more or less a recipe for solace. When he lay awake in his bunk at night, his own problems felt so amorphous. In his dreams, they were as infinite as mirrors reflecting one another. But in the radio repair shop, in the innards of a Magnavox, problems could be picked off, hunted down, cornered. They could be eliminated with a cotton swab, a piece of copper braid, or a drop of solder. And he had always loved the sugary tang of solder smoke, hot off the tip of the iron. Even on those nights when Dr. Stewart showed up in the hut, he was easier for my grandfather to handle or to ignore. Storch would put on a headset and sit for hours in front of the Hallicrafters in the corner. He took in the news from Radio Nacional in Brazil, from Radio Moscow, from Deutsche Welle. He monitored the chatter and technical rundowns broadcast by stargazers and weather watchers around the world who had been recruited to record and transmit their observations during this international geophysical year. He lost himself amid the interlacing transmissions of a million solitary amateurs reaching out to one another in the night. On the first Friday evening of my grandfather's first October at Wallkill, Hub Gorman wandered into the hut. It was not a customary haunt of Gorman's, and my grandfather saw at once that he was looking to make trouble. Gorman stood for a moment just inside the doorway. He nodded to my grandfather. His close-cropped skull was indented on one side as by the corner of a 2x4. In the crevice formed by his brow and cheekbones, his eyes glinted like dimes lost between sofa cushions. He had spotted Dr. Storch in the corner, his back to the door and the trouble that had just shambled through it. Gorman started across the lab with practiced slowness. The man took his time to do almost anything. Roll a cigarette, get out of a chair, finish a bowl of chili con carne, lick the spoon. When a guard gave him an order, he pondered it. His languor was partly a kind of insubordination through indifference. It was also a manner of predation. He was an alligator sunning himself on a rock. "Gorman," my grandfather said, "come here, look at this." Gorman stopped. He was only 2 or 3 feet from Dr. Storch. He cracked his knuckles. It sounded like a string of squibs going off. He turned with the usual show of hastelessness. My grandfather held up a gaudy gold and red box that once held 2 dozen Romeo y Julietas. "Don't smoke," Gorman said. He pointed at his mouth with a knobby finger. "Chew gum, not cigars." The cleft between Gorman's cheeks and brows grew diminished. He made his way over to the electronics workbench. "Don't bring him over here, dumbass," said another prisoner, who had served as a radio man on the Abraham Lincoln during the war. "What do you care if he wants to fuck with the Nazi?" "What is it?" Gorman said.
Across the hemisphere of his left arm, some jarhead tattooist had mapped, island by greenish-black island, month by month, year by year, the bloody advance of the 10th Marines on the Empire of Japan. The shoulder featured a mushroom cloud labeled Nagasaki, where the 10th had patrolled the cinders post-war. It's a radio made out of a cigar box. It was the work of a night, completed just 5 minutes or so before Gorman's appearance in the hut. My grandfather had intended to present it as a gift for the warden's grandson, Theodore, the next time the boy visited. Theodore took an interest in science. He was bright and forthright, and not in awe of the prison, its inmates, or his grandfather. Among inmates who pined for their own children, Theodore was a great favorite. They showered him with matchstick Eiffel Towers and tin can roadsters. My grandfather handed the cigar box to Gorman, who hefted it. Heavy. It runs on a flashlight battery. My grandfather opened the lid to show Gorman the battery amid the capacitors and wires. He took out the little gray earphone on its braided gray wire, and Gorman poked it into the pleats and convolutions of his deformed right ear. My grandfather showed Gorman how to turn on and tune the radio. Gorman asked him to find the church station, and my grandfather did. Gorman grinned. "Hey," he said, "a radio and a cigar box, that's pretty neat." But Gorman did not leave to go play with his new toy as my grandfather had hoped. He found a stool and sat, listening to a radio preacher. He stared at the back of Dr. Storch's head, while the cricket in his cauliflower ear preached damnation. Then, without any apparent stimulus or cue, he stood up, tugged the earphone loose, wrapped the thin wire around three fingers, put the coil of wire inside the cigar box, and laid the box on the stool. The animal inside him was ready to dine. Gorman sidled over to the radio corner. My grandfather opened his mouth to warn Dr. Storch, but just at that moment, the dentist's shoulders tensed and he turned to face his looming tormentor, eyes level with Guadalcanal on the back of Gorman's wrist. Gorman crouched beside Storch and laid his arm across the man's bony shoulders. He put his mouth to Storch's ear. His lips moved. He spoke into Storch's ear for a long time, renewing his grip on Storch's shoulders every few minutes. His voice was low, and the precise text of his sermon remained a mystery to my grandfather 30 years later. When he was through delivering it, he let Storch shed the yoke of his arm. He unbent himself and looked down at Storch with a pastoral smile. "Okay," he said audibly now. "That going to be all right with you?" Storch was crying. The howls of the ionosphere leaked from the earpiece of the helicrafter's headset. "Alfred, I can't hear you." "How about you leave the poor bastard alone for a change?" said my grandfather. Gorman's chin, followed by his lips, was on its way back down to the neighborhood of Storch's left ear. It took a long moment for my grandfather's words to have their effect. Gorman turned to my grandfather, raising himself to his full height. He had 3, call it 4 inches on my grandfather. In the hollow of his face, his pocket change eyes flickered. With practiced care, he reviewed the stats he had amassed and recorded so far on my grandfather. The smile that he had pasted to his face fell off. My grandfather never saw it again. Gorman raised his hands to just below his chin, getting his guard up. He agitated the thumbs. "How about I stick these things right into your fucking eyeballs, okay? And they get Alfred here to lick the jelly off them," he said. The notion genuinely seemed to appeal to him. "Then I can fuck both bloody holes in your skull." Against his better judgment, my grandfather glanced at Storch, who had stopped crying but whose cheeks were fiery red. The lenses of his eyeglasses were fogged, but my grandfather could see through the fog that Storch expected him, needed him, to do something, to stand up for him, to fight. He needed my grandfather to be his friend. My grandfather stared at the gaudy labels of radio tubes in their boxes
ranged on a shelf against the wall and serially counted to 10, first in English, then in German, and finally in Yiddish. Even if he could survive a fight with Hub Gorman, which was far from certain, months or years might be added to his bid as a result. He might be transferred to some place far worse than Wallkill, some place where the fights were butchery and the sentences long. And in the end, Storch would still be a hapless nudnik of an ex-dentist, and my mother and grandmother would be obliged to stumble onward, lost and alone. Gorman picked up the cigar box, took out the earphone, and poked it back into his ear. He turned the knob that controlled tuning and stopped at something that sounded like it might be Jump Blues, the 4/4 scratch of drums. Gorman bobbed his head in time and winked at my grandfather. "A radio and a cigar box," he said. "That is just neat." That night, the shortwave frequencies lit up with the news that the Soviet Union had used a rocket to deploy Sputnik, the first artificial satellite into orbit around the Earth. The satellite transmitted a signal every 0.3 of a second on a frequency of 20 megahertz, and between those pulses another signal of 40 megahertz. Radio amateurs and shortwave listeners all over the world were able to tune in and listen to what struck many of them as the voice of the future itself. Dr. Storch did not hear the signals, and my grandfather did not learn about Sputnik's deployment until the next day. As soon as Gorman was gone, Dr. Storch hung the radio headset from its peg on the wall, got up from the swivel chair, and walked out of the hut without looking at my grandfather. When he got back to his cell, he swallowed 52 aspirin tablets he had painstakingly accumulated over a period of years by pretending to suffer from chronic headaches. That night a grinding sound woke my grandfather like a key being turned in the ignition of an engine that was already running. It was the sound of Dr. Storch vomiting. My grandfather ignored it for as long as he could, which was not very long, although it felt like forever. He got up and went into Dr. Storch's cell, reeling at the rancid smell of undigested aspirin. Dr. Storch lay conscious and making a sound that was somewhere between a low rhythmic moan of pain that would not stop throbbing and a sigh of unbearable regret. "Never mind," he said to my grandfather, though he was confused and did not seem to know it was my grandfather grabbing him, dragging him out into the corridor, raising an alarm. "Never mind, never mind." After the medical staff had come with a stretcher and carried Dr. Storch off to the prison's ambulance, my grandfather got hold of a bucket and mop and did what he could about the mess in Storch's cell so that it would be all right when they returned him. They would keep him a few days, then bring him back, and it would all start over again. For him, with Gorman, only now it would be worse. Gorman would be encouraged by his near miss, and Storch would be more vulnerable than ever. My grandfather cleaned himself up and returned to his own cell. He lay on his cot for hours, trying to focus his thoughts on his family and on the time remaining until the day they would be reunited, which diminished every day by a greater percentage than the one before. He powered up the Zeiss projector in his skull and eagerly sought Cassiopeia and Andromeda in their courses, and Cepheus, the husband and father. "That's you," he told himself. "You are Cepheus. You are not Perseus. You are not a hero. It's not your job to rescue anybody." But he could not sustain the planetarium show tonight. There was too much light pouring in from the stanchion outside his window. There was still a tang of vomit in the air. Storch was going to be kept under observation at the county hospital for 4 days. On the first day of his absence, my grandfather told the guard in charge of the grounds crew that he needed fence wire to repair the antenna of a lousy, made-in-Japan radio set that had come into the shop. For a purpose directly opposed to his present one, my grandfather had earned the guard's trust. He was believed. Once inside the potting shed, my grandfather filled the rolled cuffs of his trousers with high yield. He had noticed the grounds crew mixing this crystalline white powder with water and applying it to tree stumps at the edge of the meadow. The crew called it stump killer. It acted to soften the stumps so that rain was enough to dissolve them.
The active ingredient was basically chemical fertilizer, potassium nitrate. The second day and third day of Storch's absence, my grandfather devoted to obtaining a quantity of sugar. This was trickier. The kitchen kept an eye on sugar, because it could be used to make hooch. The cubes were counted and doled out with tongs, 2 to a prisoner per meal. My grandfather would have to stockpile for weeks. He thought of another approach. It was foolish, dangerous, and shameless, but it would be efficient. And anyway, shamelessness was often the missing piece of many otherwise brilliant schemes. A word that often cropped up when people talked or wrote about the warden of the Wallkill prison, Dr. Walter M. Wallach, was tireless. For every problem that arose in the life and administration of the prison, he came up with 3 possible solutions. He was always on the move. You never saw him sitting down. He arrived early and went home late. Part of this tirelessness was no doubt constitutional or even moral. He was a good man. But you could not discount the fact that he consumed, the legend varied, between 15 and 20 cups of coffee a day, black and sweet. He kept a percolator in his office, on top of a low bookshelf by the door, and an ample supply of sugar. After breakfast on the second day, my grandfather begged one of the cooks for an empty drum of Quaker oats. That evening he went to the hut and built a radio inside the cardboard drum. He sank a tuning knob through the Q of Quaker and a volume pot through the O of oats. He cannibalized a speaker cone from a junked unit and cut a grill for it out of the drum's paper lid. The next day he got permission to deliver the radio to Wallach in his office. He found Wallach behind his desk, standing up as usual. There was a nice leather swivel chair, but Wallach almost never sat down in it. He stood, and he leaned on top of a filing cabinet when he needed to jot something in his legal pad. The desk was bare except for a telephone, a calendar blotter, and a crude paper rocket, a foot high, clearly if unconsciously modeled on the V-2. "Very kind of you," Wallach said, taking the radio from my grandfather. "Very clever. Theo will love it, I'm sure." My grandfather showed Wallach how to operate the radio, suggesting that the warden move closer to the window to get better reception. He moved closer to the door and the shelf with the coffee percolator. Dr. Wallach turned to face the window and twiddled the knobs. He found Mozart. He found Eddie Fisher. While his back was to the room, my grandfather leaned over and grabbed one of a dozen unopened boxes of sugar cubes on the shelf below the percolator. He reached around to grab hold of his own shirt collar, jerked it away from his neck, and dropped the box of sugar cubes down the back of his shirt. Dr. Wallach turned back, and my grandfather had to put his eyes somewhere, so he put them on the rocket. A loving but clumsy hand had shaped the fins, nose cone, and sweep of the fuselage from strips of thin card around a tube left over from a roll of paper towels. The paper was crusted with dried mucilage and blotched with red, white, and blue paint. But the rocket's proportions were pretty good. There were stars and stripes and the legend USA written 20 times all up and down the thing in execrable handwriting. "Theo's work," Dr. Wallach said. "I figured. Gone space mad like all the other boys since Sputnik went up. Building rockets. Rockets to the moon. Trying to figure out how to make them really fly." "Interesting problem," my grandfather said. "I'll think about it." All you would need, he idly thought, is a little bit of sugar. He backed out of the room, scuttled past the warden's secretary, and then hurried to his cell to hide the sugar cubes. On the third night after lights out, my grandfather sat on his cot with some tape, wire, a flashlight battery, and the guts of an old clock from the scrap heap in the hut. Working by the blare of light through the window, he ground the cubes to powder in the box and then mixed in potassium nitrate, packing the sugar box as tightly as he could with the candy, as it was known. After an hour's patient work, he had a configuration of wire, battery, candy, and time that was both plausible and strictly nur zu Demonstrationszwecken. He was not sure how plausible it was that Hub Gorman would know how to construct even a rudimentary explosive device like this one, but he also wasn't sure it really mattered. The mere presence of it in Gorman's cell Once my grandfather had tipped off the guards, would likely be enough to get Gorman transferred out of Wallkill to Green Haven or Auburn or some place where he really belonged. Hub Gorman did not belong in a prison that had beehives, a creamery, a complete Encyclopedia Britannica, and a photo enlarger. Chapter 27. Dr. Storch was returned to the prison in the ambulance on the 10th of October, a Tuesday. When my grandfather heard about it after chow, he went to the hut and looked in through the door. Dr. Storch was at the S-38, lenses glinting, face gaunt and livid as an El Greco Christ's in the glow of the radio's half-moons. He had the headset on, and his movements on the dial were exceedingly fine, as if homing in on a single voice in the great megahertz chorale. My grandfather felt his eyes burn, and the muscles of his chest seemed to curl like a fist around his heart. When he first learned that the dentist would survive his suicide attempt, he had felt powerful relief. The news about Hub Gorman had added a disturbing wrinkle. On seeing Dr. Storch's gaunt, suffering face again, however, all he felt was shame. He ought to have stood up for the poor bastard in the first place. He left the hut, went to his cell, and waited for the lights to be put out. He woke to a chill touch, long, dry fingers pulling at his wrist. "Shh!" He sat up and looked out the window of his cell. It was never easy to judge the time of night with the floodlights spilling in the yard outside. Call it about an hour before dawn. Dr. Storch winced to show that he was sorry for waking my grandfather. He held up both hands and made a pushing motion that said, I know, but trust me. He gestured to the doorway of the cell and then to the ceiling. He wanted my grandfather to follow him up to the roof. A visit to the roof of this particular cell block was an exploit often discussed among the Wallkill population. It was a subject of debate. Generally, it was agreed to be possible, but no one among the current crop of inmates would or could acknowledge having done it. A solid minority believed that the roof passage was a legend, that it originated as deliberate misinformation, a trap laid by some unscrupulous guard to lure unwary prisoners into infraction. These men claimed that a guard was paid a bounty every time he caught an inmate in the act of trying to escape. My grandfather pulled on a shirt and trousers and started to put on his shoes. Storch shook his head. They went out into the corridor. They stepped softly and kept their thighs apart so that a whisper of twill would not betray them. They turned onto another corridor and went along past the doors of other men's cells to the end. There was a blank brick wall about 5 feet wide. Dr. Storch crouched down by the base of the wall. He reached into the waistband of his trousers. It was too dark for my grandfather to see what he had in the waistband, but later he found out that it was two heavy-duty paper clips, unbent up to the last involution so that they made a pair of hooks. Dr. Storch slid these hooks under the bottom edge of the wall about 3 feet apart. He held his breath and let it out and lifted the bottom of the wall up and outward. It was a hinged wooden panel, covered with a layer of bricks, cut very thin, and applied in a way that matched the course of the genuine wall. Behind it, a rectangular opening of the same dimensions as the panel led into an air duct. My grandfather afterward theorized that at one time there had been a grill over the opening, and that some clever prisoner had replaced it with the panel, camouflaged so well that, when installed, it looked as if it belonged. Dr. Storch sat down and slid his legs through, then poured the rest of himself into the hole. My grandfather heard a creak of metal, a pause, then another creak. Pause, creak, pause. The sound took on the familiar cadence of a man climbing a ladder. My grandfather hesitated. He had already taken too many crazy chances in the past week. He knew that following Storch would be tempting fate. If this exploit went wrong, it would be hard not to look back and say that he was asking to get caught. God knew he had enough on his conscience to justify that view of the matter. Inside the air duct was a smell like the taste of a new filling. My grandfather grasped the first of the rungs and pulled himself up through the darkness. The rungs had been crafted, no doubt, by the same gifted engineer from the springs of shock absorbers, likely pilfered from the prison motor pool. Whoever the guy was, he had compressed each spring between two heavy blocks of wood, clad with pieces of tire, and then allowed the spring to expand across the duct. Pressure and rubber tread held the rungs in place at the back of the duct, leaving barely enough room for the vertical passage of a man. A little under 3 minutes after they began the climb, they were standing on the roof. It was a clear night full of stars. A poignant smell of leaf smoke blew in from the backyard of some fortunate free man.
"Which way?"
my grandfather said in just above a whisper, having deduced what Dr. Storch had brought him to see.
"Northeast," Dr. Storch whispered back, "and it ought to be soon. I've been listening all night as the reports came in."
Anticipating that someone, the U.S. or Russia, would manage sooner or later to loft a satellite into orbit, a Harvard astronomer and a well-known science fiction fan named Fred Whipple had taken advantage of the publicity around the International Geophysical Year to organize a network of amateurs connected by shortwave radio. Upon news of Sputnik's launch, they had mobilized themselves all over the country, going out every night to watch the sky and report details of time and orientation. They stood in the cold and the dark. Far away, the lights of some town glittered. My grandfather inclined his face to the vast heavens until his neck began to ache.
"I was told there was an explosion," Storch said.
"Hell of a thing."
"He was making moonshine?"
So goes the theory. There had been nothing left of the candy bomb in Gorman's cell, and very little left of the cell and Gorman. There was an attempt at investigation, but the scene had been so heavily contaminated by the first guards to respond to the sound of the blast that no firm conclusions were ever drawn. My grandfather couldn't figure it out either, but he was inclined to blame the detonation on some unforeseen interaction between the clockworks in the oatmeal box and the radio in the cigar box.
"My friend,"
said the German, his voice thickened by emotion.
"Was it you?"
"Only very indirectly," my grandfather said. He told Dr. Storch about the sugar and the potassium nitrate, and explained his theory of the radio's detonation, which is really not much of a theory, as Dr. Storch pointed out.
"I would be more inclined to blame a discharge of static electricity," Dr. Storch said. "Perhaps from Gorman's wool blanket. At this time of the year, the air is so dry. I'm sure you've noticed the sparks when your hands pass across the bedclothes in the dark."
"Interesting," my grandfather said.
"Here's something else you might find interesting. I feel I'd like to inform you that I'm not here for practicing dentistry without a license," Dr. Storch said. "I thought you should know that. I've never told anybody else. I certainly never told Hub Gorman."
My grandfather waited.
"The reason I'm here is that one day I had a little boy in my chair, a very nice, well-mannered 12-year-old boy named Walter Onderdonk, and for reasons that remain beyond my understanding, I made a mistake with the gas. A big mistake, a terrible mistake."
Dr. Storch started to cry softly. And even though he was a German and a nudnik and a pain in the ass, my grandfather put his arm around the poor bastard.
"Oh,"
Dr. Storch said. He pointed to the northeast. My grandfather felt his heart leap. A star had popped loose from its constellation and gone rolling down the sky. It was falling, but it was not a falling star. It did not flare up and wink out, and leave a glowing ghost mark on the retinas. It just kept falling and falling and falling, until it disappeared behind the curvature of the earth. It was a prisoner of gravity like everything in the universe. Its orbit would degrade. It would spiral inward until it hit the air and then burn up and break apart, and leave nothing but vapor and a memory. And then in time the memory itself would fade like vapor. But to my grandfather, watching secretly from the roof of the Wallkill prison, the passage of that chunk of radiant metal seemed to describe an everlasting arc of freedom.
"Wow," he said. "Look at that."
"Sputnik," Dr. Stort said with a childish glee. My grandfather thought about correcting Dr. Storch. It was not Sputnik itself, which was far too small to be seen by the naked human eye. What they had seen was a section of the rocket that had boosted the satellite into orbit, burnished by the rays of the imminent sun. He decided that, for now, he would let it pass.
"Thanks," he said instead. "Thank you, Storch, for bringing me to see it."
"Please," Dr. Storch said. "It's the least I could do."
A feather of blue brushed the bottom of the sky like breath on a mirror. It was time to get back to their cells. Neither of them moved. They stood there on the roof in the darkness.
"I want to see it again," my grandfather thought.
"Well," Dr. Stort said, what shall we do?
My grandfather was surprised to find that he had an answer ready for this question, and surprised by the answer itself, though he saw now that it had been percolating inside him since the day of the sugar heist in Dr. Wallach's office.
"How about we make ourselves a rocket?" said my grandfather.
Chapter 28 I never knew my other grandfather. One afternoon, about a month before I was born, he sat down with his brother, Sam Shaben, my Uncle Sammy, for their weekly lunch at a Midtown deli where, on every table in the place of butter, they put out a pot of schmaltz. When they had finished their pastrami sandwiches, my other grandfather walked Sammy back to the latter's offices on the fourth floor of the Lincoln Building, a couple of blocks away. One of Sammy's suppliers had just delivered a sample, a working model of the nuclear submarine Nautilus, which they were planning to bring out in time for Christmas. "It was," Sammy said, "a marvel. It had functional ballast tanks that operated by means of a pocket-sized circular bellows and a length of plastic tubing. A large wash tub had been brought into the office and filled with water. The salesman had been playing with it all morning. My other grandfather was eager to get a crack at it. The elevators that served the Lincoln Building's lower floors were undergoing maintenance that day. Neither brother was a patient man. They took the stairs. As he rounded the third floor landing, Sammy heard his brother, a flight of stairs below him, cluck his tongue and sigh as if experiencing a moment of regret. An ambulance was sent for, but my other grandfather died on the way to the hospital. 3 weeks later, my mother went into labor. She was 20 and made quick work of the job. 8 days after that, I exchanged my foreskin for the dead man's Hebrew name. In my non-memory of my other grandfather, he is a human Spalding, round and pink. His cheeks and pate shine as if smeared with rich fat. My other grandfather had made a living all his life as a printer and typesetter. During the 30s, he worked for a firm that printed movie posters. In the same West Side loft building as the print shop, there was a company that dealt in cheap novelties and tools for practical jokers. One day he happened to hear that the novelty company had an opening for a salesman. He passed the word to his kid brother, who got the job. Sam Shaben went on the road, selling onion gum, black soap, ink-squirting boutonnieres. He had an affable nature, threaded with a strand of cruelty, and like a fat chef, he took pleasure in his stock and trade. But by the early 50s, his career had stalled. Raises came less frequently. Promotions passed him by. His ideas were ignored or misappropriated. He went through life trying doorknobs on locked doors. One day he found a knob that turned. On a wet Friday afternoon at Jack Dempsey's in 1954, he struck up a conversation with his neighbor at the bar. The man, like Uncle Sammy, was nursing a Tom Collins. At his feet, in a pool of rain, stood a wooden sample case that might hold scientific instruments or specialty glassware. The man turned out to be a chemist for Corning. In his spare time, he had designed a process for manufacturing imitation bone from one of the new synthetic plastics that were revolutionizing every field, including cheap novelties, where they made possible gags of great realism like fake vomit and fly an ice cube. The chemist showed my uncle what was in the sample case. He stood it upright on the bar and opened it like a book. Nestled in flocked notches on the left side were a human mandible, a femur, two ribs, five vertebrae, and a patella, molded from plastic, all life-size. On the right was a 1-to-4 scale plastic model of a full human skeleton and a wire stand for displaying it. Sammy was enchanted by the model skeleton dangling by its 3-inch skull from the hook of the wire stand. He shook its little hand. He made it kick a maraschino cherry across the tabletop. He articulated its jaw while talking in the voice of Signor Wences. "How much do you get for these?" he asked the imitation bones man. "I love it." The imitation bones man was taken aback and a little offended. His product had serious purpose. It was intended as an educational aid for medical students, biology classrooms. It was a realistic and accurate scientific tool. "I don't think you understand," he said. "That's just a demonstration model. I made it small so it would be portable, fit in a sample case." "I don't think you understand," Sammy said, knowing a novelty when he saw one. "Make it 2 inches smaller, I'll place an order for 5,000 of them." 2 years later, he was headquartered in the Lincoln Building and clearing $2 million a year. His angle was science and educational value. The novelties he sold purported, at least implicitly, to prepare America's youth for the challenges of a Cold War future. His product list included a paper airplane wind tunnel and a pocket periscope. But the sales leader had remained the exact skeleton model advertised in national magazines. Obviously a must for everyone's closet. Shipped in the hundreds of thousands to purchasers all over the world. By 1957, however, business had begun to flag. There was competition from Japan, as accurate but cheaply made mini-skeletons flooded the market. Uncle Sammy looked for ways to lower his production costs. He ran into labor trouble, union activity. One day, a pinochle crony happened to mention that he played golf with a fellow in charge of a state program that provided prisoner labor to private manufacturers in return for vocational training. That was how the so-called bone factory had come to occupy a production floor at the prison where my grandfather served his sentence. Sammy paid regular visits to Wallkill, keeping an eye on operations. At first he stayed at an inn in the village nearby, but there was a guest room in the warden's house on the grounds. And after Sammy showed up 2 or 3 times bearing a bottle of the warden's brand of rye, he received a standing invitation to sleep there whenever he visited. He could have let his production manager handle the chore, but, like many visitors, he found something soothing in the ambience of the prison, with its dairying and forestry, its choral group singing chanties and spirituals, its population making themselves useful, sweeping the winding paths between ivy-clad buildings. He had come to see himself as harried by work, and hectored by his family, and when he visited the prison he would fantasize that he, too, had been relieved of his burdens, along with his liberty. He slept well in the warden's guest room, waking refreshed, and would return to the city ready to contend with the latest importunements. He was standing at the window of the guest bedroom early one morning, still in his pajamas, when he noticed a group of men walking across the oval of the running track. 2 of the men were uniformed guards, 2 were prisoners in gray, and 1 appeared to be the warden in a plaid hunting jacket and galoshes, walking beside a boy of 12 or so, the grandson, Theodore. One of the prisoners was a fireplug, chesty and bow-legged, humping a large packing crate. The other prisoner was tall and thin, and walking backward in front of the prisoner with the big box. He was talking with his hands. Every so often he stumbled, and once he bumped into a guard, but he never stopped walking backward or talking. Even at a distance of 100 yards, Sammy pegged the guy for a nudnik. When the 5 men came to the wire fence that enclosed the dairy pasture, the guards and the warden struggled over it. The nudnik folded himself like a note and slid his body into the slot between the wires. The fireplug hoisted the crate over the fence, consigned it to the guards, it took both of them to hold it, and leapfrogged the fence post with both hands. The guards gave him back the packing crate. But Nudnik hung back a moment, and then followed the fireplug out into the pasture. It was just past sunrise, and there was not a cow to be seen. Sammy went to his overnight bag and took out his own personal pair of powerful pocket binoculars. He saw the warden holding the boy back, the guards keeping their distance, not going much beyond the fence. The fireplug carried the box deeper into the pasture, coming right into line with the window of the warden's guest bedroom. He moved fast, and the Nudnik struggled to keep up. The two prisoners began to empty and assemble the crate's contents into a configuration that left Sammy puzzled. As far as he could tell, they had stood a long, slender cage of latticework on end in the middle of the field. It reached nearly to the fireplug's waist and seemed to have been made out of some kind of wire or narrow-gauge pipe. The two men anchored it to the turf with wire cleats. The fireplug removed what appeared to be a length of pipe from the box, fitted at one end with vanes. Some kind of turbine, maybe, or an anemometer. It was lowered into the latticed cage. The prisoners knelt down on either side of the thing, making adjustments. The fireplug had his back to Sammy, and his body blocked the view of whatever they were up to for a good 2 or 3 minutes. The warden fit a cigarette to his face, and one of the guards lit it for him. At last, the Nudnik clambered back, stumbling, in a hurry. Afraid, Uncle Sammy almost would have said. The fireplug rose and took 10 slow steps backward, then counted another 10. He stopped. The warden and the guards came away from the fence and crowded in behind the fireplug, who seemed to be in charge of the operation. Toward the bottom of the latticed cage, a light kindled, intense and blue. It was like the powder burst of a camera, but it was not a flash. Its light held as it grew downward toward the ground. Presently, my great-uncle caught the sound of it, even through the window glass. It reminded him of the sound of water spraying from a fire hydrant, tapped by street kids on an August afternoon. It was a sound that filled him with a pleasant anticipation of mischief. With a shimmy and a hesitation, the finned tube that Sammy had taken for a wind gauge peeped its head out from the top of the latticework cage. It took one slow second to climb 20 feet into the air, and then 2 more seconds to streak an arcing shimmer into the heavens, canted 2 degrees off the perpendicular. Sammy lost sight of the thing against some clouds, and then, a moment later, in a patch of blue 500 feet higher, found it again. His heart slipped its accustomed bonds. "A rocket," he said to the guest bedroom of the warden's house. It burst like a kernel of popcorn, sprouting a sudden white blossom that turned out to be a parachute. Thin and high, the boy's voice carried to Sammy's ear, "Wow!" The kid was literally jumping up and down with excitement as the rocket, a rocket, floated, broken-necked, down from heaven. The Nudnik waited for it, drifting now this way, now that way, head tilted back, a center fielder getting under a lazy can of corn. As the rocket slanted past him, he leaped up and snatched at it and missed it, and fell over and lost his glasses. The rocket lay down on the grass. The parachute draped itself over the rocket. The Nudnik found his glasses. He picked up the rocket and the chute and carried them back to the fireplug. The two prisoners shook hands without letting go, for as long as it took the warden and the guards to reach them. Pats on the back, more shaking of hands all around. Sam tried to express in that moment the spasm of joy passing through him as he watched the launch of my grandfather's first model rocket. "I could sell a ton of those things," he said, fogging the window pane, wiping it clean with the cuff of his pajamas. Chapter 29. I was stretched out on the sofa in my mother's living room, reading 9 stories. It was a sofa of the 70s, covered in synthetic wool of lunar gray, poofy yet severe. Beyond my bare feet, a set of sliding glass doors gave onto a redwood deck. At the back of the house, the hillside fell away with alarming verticality. The trees here had been topped to permit constant monitoring. as by some fairy tale miser of the two-bridge view in which a puzzling percentage of the house's value was felt to lie. Down below, at the western verge of Oakland, car lights scrolled along the interchanges like cryptic headlines on a zipper. San Francisco was an amber radiance of fog. I can't say for sure which of the nine I was reading when my mother came in that night, but my favorite has always been For Esme, with Love and Squalor. For the first time I read it in high school, this story and its protagonist had reminded me of my grandfather. The scant details had been provided at the time about his army career, ETO, a brief stay in London before being shipped over to France, some kind of intelligence work portrayed variously as clerical in nature, or nothing too exciting, seemed to coincide with the situation of Salinger's autobiographical Sergeant X. Nobody had ever used the phrase nervous breakdown, or suggested that my grandfather had not returned from the war with his faculties intact, as Esme puts it in the story. I had never thought of my grandfather as a man suffering from lingering effects of the condition his generation called combat fatigue. And yet, Salinger's story seemed to offer an explanation for something about my grandfather that must have felt to me, always, like it needed to be explained. My mother came in holding a glass of scotch, which she took, poured over a handful of ice. She had on an old pink nightgown, wrapped in a brown chenille robe. It was late. The night nurse had been on the job for a couple of hours, time my mother had spent combing out tangles in my grandfather's taxes. Apparently, she had found an error in my grandfather's favor that would save him nearly $1,000. That explained the tumbler of Johnny Walker. She was holding an old photo album bound in black cardboard, impressed to resemble grained leather. The spine at top and bottom had split and frayed. "Hey, I wanted to show you this," she said. She sat down beside me. Her hair was damp, and she smelled of Prel shampoo. It was her essential odor, cool as mint and somehow impervious. The actual fragrance of Prel was not at all minty, but it had a mentholated color, and in the old TV commercials, a pearl would be shown descending languid and impervious through the green depths of a bottle of Prel. I never figured out what the ability of Prel to retard a pearl's descent implied about its hair-cleaning power, but the sight of that descent, like my mother, was always quietly impressive. As she sat down beside me on the Herculean sofa, the photo album snowed gray feathers of rotted paper. "This was your grandmother's?" Across the album's cover in a slab serif type, the word souvenirs were stamped in gilt that had flaked away. There was a kind of fake leather strap that wrapped around the album's front edge from back to front where it snapped into a clasp, like a diary with no lock. I was pretty sure I'd never seen the thing before. "I don't know what all he's been telling you," my mother said. I thought her tone held something accusatory of my grandfather or of me for my narrative appetite. But I might have been wrong about that. "He's not telling me anything."
"I heard him telling you about my mother."
"Well, yeah."
"And how I had to go live with Uncle Ray while he was serving time."
"Yeah, he told me that."
She had a certain eyebrow arch of her own that she could wield. I acknowledged that my grandfather, come to think of it, might have been telling me some things. "Well, I just thought you might like to see this. It was one of the two belongings my mother brought over with her."
"What was the other thing?"
"Me."
"Oh, right, duh."
"I took it with me to Baltimore," she said. "When I went to live with Uncle Ray, I found it in the attic right before we moved."
"In the house in Hohokus?"
"We were packing to leave. Your grandmother had already gone into the hospital. I found this and just kind of grabbed it. I don't know why. I'd never seen it before." She ran a finger across the flaking gilt legend on the cover. "Souvenirs, as in memories in French." She drank a little of the scotch. Her eyes widened, and she let out a gasp.
"Whoa!" "Easy there."
"All right," she said. "Okay."
But she just sat there, looking down at the album in her lap. "Want to do this another time?"
"No, it's fine. I just haven't, you know, it's been a while since I looked."
She took another longer pull. This time it seemed to go down more easily.
The funny thing is, she didn't really have any photos to put in the album. I mean, she had four. That was page one.
I tried to imagine how I would feel about the only four pictures to survive from the entire photographic record of my life to date. More or less the age of my grandmother when she arrived in the U.S. They might be four that I had chosen for their personal value, true likenesses, moments I could not bear to lose. They might be random shots, a portrait of my acne and my orthodontia, a grinning blur that was my father's face as he turned to laugh at something out of the frame. I knew that either way, they would be precious to me, but having endured what my grandmother had endured did not mean I would be able to bring myself to look at them. At first, I didn't understand. If you only have four pictures, why buy a whole album? Then I thought, well, probably she meant to fill it with pictures of her new life here. And then maybe she forgot. Or got another album, I don't know. We had plenty of other albums. You've seen them.
Sure.
So I decided I would take it, fill in the rest of the pages myself.
The rest of it was blank when you found it?
She nodded and let out a long breath. Its turbulence wove a paisley of dust motes in the slant of lamplight.
We can skip that page.
No. She undid the clasp and opened the old-fashioned album to its first black page. It was the kind of album where the photos had to be fixed to the pages by means of self-adhesive mounts, like little corners of black crown molding. There were 16 corners pasted to the page, neat and true. Four labels, tan rectangles with indented corners, each bearing a legend written with a fountain pen in the continental hand I remembered from birthday cards, enclosing $20 checks. Mère, 20 ans, père, toi, et moi. Above each label, inside a rectangular space delimited by the photo corners, was a region of black paper. The pictures themselves were all missing.
What?
My mother said to the photo album. She lifted it from her lap to look pointlessly underneath. She set it back down.
Oh, no,
she said. She started flipping pages, and we flashed through the world in which her childhood had come to an end. Recorded in grids of black and white squares, pictures unmistakably taken with a Kodak Brownie. She flipped them faster, and as she went, she was breathing through her nostrils like someone trying to hold her temper or her worst fears in check. The pages creaked as she turned them. I glimpsed a row of motel cabins, a motel swimming pool shaped like an arrowhead, a motel sign with a neon thunderbird, a beach at low tide, a beach awash in umbrellas, my mother with a bare-chested lifeguard, my mother in a poodle skirt nervously passing a hot dog on a bun to a bear on a chain,
Uncle Ray looking sporting in a double-breasted suit and an open-shirt collar with a clocked foulard,
my mother in short shorts and a halter top posing beside the wooden Indian of a cigar shop, my mother, too young to drive, behind the wheel of a parked Alpha convertible. Another print of the picture my grandfather had brought with him from Florida. The one that showed my mother riding bareback in a bathing suit, holding a bow and arrow. A jockey in silks, posing with a glossy thoroughbred, squinting at a man in a snap-brim hat. Other shots of horses, and the fences, and grandstands of racetracks. Shots that featured my mother, or Uncle Ray, with a zufted little woman who had smoldering, even angry, eyes. Shots of my mother or her uncle posed beside other women with lipstick-dark mouths. My mother and Uncle Ray in front of a billiard parlor. My mother in front of the Lincoln Memorial, the gates of Pimlico racetrack, some historical palisaded fort. My mother astride an artillery cannon like Kipling's Kim. The world before my birth, a world of infinite degrees of gray. Gray ocean, gray blondes, gray ketchup, gray pines. Apart from the horseback shot, I had never seen any of these pictures. I had heard only the dimmest rumors of the period they recorded. I wanted to stop her hand from turning the pages and sink, like the pearl in the shampoo bottle, into this gray prehistory, this evidence of the years my mother had spent running wild. The pictures flicked past.